My name is Susie. I have three children, the youngest of whom struggles with anxiety, depression, and suicidal ideation. I never thought this could happen to me, and I miss the signs. Being a parent is really hard, but I'm here to help. I'm talking to other parents and experts to help you with the struggles that your kids may face. I want you to know that you are not alone and there is hope.
Once see you smile again, take away that pain in them clouds that keep covering up the sun.
On this episode of the Just a Mom podcast, I am really honored and overjoyed, truly, to be in the virtual Just a Mom podcast studio with a lifelong friend. I was about to say old, but then I thought that would date us. A lifelong friend that I've known for, over 30 years. Oh, wow. Again, that dates us. But Kyle is in the studio with me today. Kyle, thank you so much for being willing to share your story with the Just a Mom podcast listeners.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Susie. I've been looking forward to finally getting together with you and to talk about this.
Yes, Kyle is a very busy, busy person, and it's taken us a while to get this on the books, but I'm thrilled to have this opportunity because I know your story, and it's going to be a real encouragement to our listeners, and I just want to jump right in and get started. So why don't you just give us a little background about your family and how your journey as a parent with a child who struggles with mental illness started?
So I have four, they're not really children anymore, but I have four offspring. My oldest, which is probably going to be, I'd say, the primary focus of our conversation, B, she's, they're 20 years old now. And then right behind her is my number two, is Kara. She's 19. And then I still have Thomas, who's a sophomore in high school. He's 16. And Maeve's going to be a freshman next year. So she's in eighth grade. She's 14 right now. And so got my hands full.
Yes, you do. And no matter how old they get, I can say from personal experience, they're always your children. So even though they're semi-adults to adults, I still feel like, you know, my 26-year-old is still my baby too. So let's just get into the story of your struggles and how, in your opinion or your experience, how you feel like things kind of started with your child's struggle.
Yeah, so this is primarily around B. And at the time, we were living right after fellowship, we had moved to Richmond, Virginia, and had B the very first year, the very first month we moved in, actually. And then the year after, we had Kira. And, you know, the typical, you know, at that time, Southern type of family upbringing, you know, for the kids type of thing. And, you know, everything seemed to be going just like every other person in the cul-de-sac. I mean, it was very kind of a nondescript, relatively straightforward, you know, boring type of, you know, family, which was, you know, totally fine, you know, summer vacation types, trips down, you know, this, because of where we were, we could take trips that were, you know, not usually available to most. We could go up to DC any weekend we wanted to, and we could go down to the Outer Banks or to Hilton Head, you know, just a half a day drive. So we were fortunate we had that at our, you know, fingertips, unlike the Lake Ozarks, you know, for the Kansas City folks. And everything, you know, was going okay. One of the first things that I started, when I look back now, a lot of this was missed. And I think it's probably a common theme after I've listened to a lot of the blogs that you've had on here, a lot of the guests. And a common theme, I think, at least for us, for parents, is we missed some of those very early signs. And I'm a physician. I'm not in mental health. I'm in, you know, critical care and emergency medicine. So I thought that, you know, these are things that there's no way I'm going to miss them. You know, I can pick them up. But when they're your kids and you're with, or your family, and you're with them all the time, every day, you do miss these things. You know, it's very hard to validate, you know, when you don't even really know what that word means if you're not in healthcare, especially almost 20 years ago. And so as, you know, B was, you know, growing up, you know, when she was probably in her 5, 6, 7 years old, she, you know, she would come to us, her mom and I, at the time, and would tell us that there was something wrong with her brain, something wrong in her head. She didn't think the way most of the kids did, and she was, you know, when she learned the word depressed, she started using, I feel depressed, and then she started, you know, saying things along those lines. And I know personally, I didn't really validate that. I just kind of brushed it off, like, you know, now you're being, you know, very suggestive, and you're hearing other people talk about it. And, you know, at the time, it's, you know, it was starting to get some popularity on the radio and on the TV shows. You know, people were talking about it, and, you know, just thought that she was picking that up from, you know, from other media, and ignored it. You know, we listened to her, but didn't really take it seriously, you know, and then as, you know, and then she just stopped talking about it. And she hid it very well. And then as, you know, we had more kids come in, and as, you know, the family dynamics grow, and when you have, you know, 4 kids, you know, the interactions happen, and Bridget, you know, started voicing this more as we got, she got older. But again, you know, these thoughts really weren't validated. We were very busy, you know, raising a family, you know, getting a career started, and thought that, you know, she was too young to really have this. You know, it's like, how can a 5-year-old or 6-year-old truly be depressed? There's nothing to be depressed about. You know, that's my ignorance, completely my ignorance about it, right? And so didn't even think about it. You know, after about 10 years, then, you know, careers, you know, had a career opportunity, moved to Michigan. So we moved as a family and, you know, started back, you know, our life here. And, you know, things were, you know, going fairly the same as they were back in Virginia, just a new location. But the kids are now older and they're starting to express themselves more. And now I'm starting to hear from multiple kids. There are some things that were going in the family I'm not going to get into great detail with, but, you know, you look back on it now and there is just a lot of emotional trauma that was really escalating and bouncing around in the family. It had been going around a long, long time that contributed to this. And, you know, part of it also, I think, allowed B to suppress it a lot too, because I think, you know, talking with her now about this, she realized she wasn't going to get anywhere with us. I've been more, you know, talking to me, that she didn't really bring it up until probably into her middle school years, which are tough for all kids. They were tough for B too, trying to find her place. She was a great student, great athlete, very introverted, very shy. And, you know, I also had some, at that time of maturity, emotional maturity, she wasn't getting some of the reinforcements and encouragement that you really need from role models. And it was really starting to, you know, hurt her. And as you know, all of our kids express their feelings in different ways. And B internalizes everything, takes it all, you know, and takes it out on herself. Kira, my number two, is an external expressor. She, I mean, you know exactly how she feels. I mean, she's, you know, explodes, you know exactly what's going on. Thomas, my number three, you know, he's kind of like his older sister and, you know, internalizes it. And then my younger one, she just is like number two. She expresses everything. So as you learn, and there are different ways of expression, you know, B was really just internalizing everything and getting sadder and sadder. And, you know, she started, you know, experimenting at that time. Vaping was like the thing, you know, going around. So she, you know, would try one of, you know, these vape things when she, I think she was seventh grade maybe. And then, of course, because she's a rule follower, she had to tell us and, you know, said that. But, you know, these are all little things that were going outside of really who she was, and, you know, as she was growing up. And she speak, you know, and I think these were starting to be little cries of, you know, I want your attention. I want you to listen to me. You're not doing it the way I need it from the traditional way. Let me kind of step out of what my role is in this family, and maybe I'll get your attention that way. Mm. We can talk about this.
So seventh grade-ish, roughly.
That was the first kind of sign with this.
Okay.
Probably seventh going into eighth grade. Probably eighth grade, yeah. And then freshman year was really tough. This was, I think, around 2017. Actually, she did really well on paper and from the surface. Straight A's, lettered in field hockey and lacrosse, you know, did really well. But there was a lot of things at school that were going on, picking on, making fun of, a lot of negative, you know, body image, you know, things that happen, especially, you know, it happens with boys and girls, but more so, at least we're aware of it more with girls and boys. Boys just simply never even really talk about it, I think, to this day. But really with her, which really wasn't getting a lot of support back home either. And that freshman year, she just was holding on for dear life. And she finally came to me and said, I really need to talk to somebody. I really need help. This is really getting bad. And I want a therapist.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And that's when I talked with her mom. That was right after freshman year. It's like, okay. And again, it took a while. And then it took a while. Unfortunately, the mental health care environment, even for a physician, is extremely challenging to find somebody to get your kids into to talk with.
I'm glad you brought that up because, well, just you being a physician in general, I think that we had a similar experience, as you know, with Dan being a physician, that, you know, we all assume that because, you know, you're a physician, you know when something's off or not right and can diagnose all kinds of things, even if it's not in your area of expertise. And so that is something I think is really important for parents to hear is that, you know what, we missed it too. And I'm a physician and we have the same kind of story. And because you brought up a really good point, you wouldn't expect a five-year-old to be struggling with depression, but it happens. And how great that B came to you and asked for help. That also doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, it turned out as this story kind of progresses, I was her safe person.
Yeah,
and I still am, for that matter, which would be beautiful. We've always had a really loving, you know, relationship. I had that with all my kids. And it's very painful, too. You know, the good comes with the bad. So, but the other thing that you bring up is that we're in a healthcare crisis, and we've been in one for a long time.
Yes,
and emergency medicine, the crowding, all that gets a lot of airplay now. Finally, it deservedly does. You know, after 20, 25 years of, you know, if anybody's been to an emergency department, they know they got to wait. You know, unless you're really suffering from a heart attack or a car crash or something. And the weights are getting horrible, but just as bad as, you know, mental health, accessibility, and then even insurance. Mm. That's the other part that's not even mentioned a lot.
Yes.
Is that maybe you'll find, you know, a mental health provider that's seeing new patients, but they're not taking insurance. So that's all on you now to try and negotiate those waters.
And it's so expensive.
Oh, it's,
yes. So when you started looking for a therapist for B, and you bring up these wonderful points. Again, people think that because you're in healthcare, it should be a piece of cake, no problem. You know all these people, et cetera. What roadblocks did you run up against trying to find a therapist?
Well, first, trying to find a pediatric, you know, therapist. There's just, you know, and we're here in a relatively, it's not Kansas City, it's a relatively, you know, 150,000 people here in Ann Arbor, in the Ann Arbor area, and University of Michigan's right here, and we have huge, you know, department training programs all throughout the area here that do a great job of training mental health care professionals of all shapes and sizes, from psychiatrists to psychologists to, you know, social workers with various, you know, specialties of, you know, mental health expertise. And still it's saturated, you know, there, we just couldn't, I went out and just finally called the chair of psychiatry, you know, started off with the emergency psych department and then just went to call the chair.
Wow.
And he put me literally with phone numbers that I probably could have pulled off Google, but he just gave me some, you know, I could go either go to the residency clinic, which was fine. We tried that, but that was still a 6 month wait before we could get in.
Wow.
Or I could just call around. And he said he thought there were some new social workers moving into a local area that, a local a group practice here downtown Ann Arbor. And I just cold called them. Or actually, B's mom actually did, I think, at that time, just called around and found some that were, you know, available. And we got lucked out after about, I think, 2 months.
Wow.
And found somebody that could take B and start. And, you know, also, if it's not a great fit, you don't really have a lot of recourse, right?
Right.
Because, you know, and we always talk about that. Well, if you don't get along with your doc or you don't get along with the therapist, just try on a new one. Well, if there aren't anybody around, you're kind of stuck.
Exactly. And it took you 2 months even, and that was being extremely persistent. And I want the listeners to hear that. You have to be extremely persistent and not give
up. Don't give up. You can't give up. You can't give up. So B started going and, you know, it started talking. The dynamics initially with this were a little, looking back on it now, a little strange and probably were limiting. She rarely would have one-on-one with the therapist. Her mother would usually join her. And looking back on it now, that probably was to control the narrative in some degree, which at the end of the day, meaning that the sessions with the therapist really weren't as therapeutic as they would normally be, just because it wasn't a safe space at that time. And that contributed to, you know, probably the lack of benefit that I would, you know, that one would normally expect with that. And then, when your loved one, if you're looking at it from the other side, and if your patient is in a relationship with your healthcare provider in one way or the other, regardless of who it is, if they don't feel comfortable, if it don't feel like it's a safe spot, they're not going to be honest with you because they fear retribution in some form or the one way or the other when they leave that, you know, that physical space that they're in. And, you know, I experienced that, you know, with my daughter firsthand. And we didn't get any therapeutic benefit at all, you know, early on with that.
How long did it take you to realize that there was no benefit happening?
It took a lot longer than I'd like to admit. Several months, therapy sessions were going on. And for me, I was like, you know, still working on my career. It was almost like programming a computer or fixing a problem. It's like, oh, okay, she's going with her mom. They're going to therapy. They're getting it done. We're moving in the right direction. Things are going to be great. We're going to get fixed. We're going to get through this.
Yeah.
You know, if I need to get involved, you know, would go for family sessions every now and then when, you know, whenever, you know, I always go in the queue of the healthcare provider, of the therapist. And, you know, when she wanted me to become involved and come for like a group session, I'd show up and we'd go through it. Still notice that kind of odd dynamic that was going on in, you know, in the family. And but we weren't really getting anywhere. And then, you know, at the same time, you know, there are a lot of other pressures going on, and, you know, in the family. And, you know, as you know, I, you know, it started the beginning of a, you know, our divorce, which was multifactorial, as most, you know, divorces are. But, you know, with, you know, a sick kid and, you know, other stressors in life, these all contribute to
sure.
it. And, you know, some situations right around then, B just really opened up to me and just, you know, spilled her guts of what everything that had been happening and everything that was going on. And then, you know, with her other siblings, you know, that were too afraid to really, you know, come out and talk about what was really going on. And then it was like a big weight off of her chest, it seemed like.
Sure.
And we got through the winter or into the winter. And then I just remember I was after a midnight shift, and it was maybe a Saturday, or B was home for some reason, and I was home alone with her. I think maybe mom had the kids somewhere, and, you know, that was the first where B came to me and told me she had an attempt.
Mm.
You know, she, you know, woke me up. She was crying. Mm. You know, we're I think the first one was, you know, she took Tylenol.
Mm.
And she counted out, you know, the number, you know, she looked it up of how much would be toxic and took just under that. I mean, she was very calculated. It was obviously a cry for help. But that was the first, you know, so I took her, you know, in, you know, to the emergency department. And that started the second phase of this journey, which then was just a living nightmare for the next, you know, 2.5-3 years.
How did you feel when she came in to your room and woke you up? Is that what I heard you say? And how did you feel?
Yeah, I was disoriented, as you can imagine, waking up like that. And then, you know, the first thing that comes to my mind was the medical part.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, you know, you came to me early. When did you take it? How much did you take? Okay, let's go. We can fix this.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Back again, I want to fix things, right? You know, took her, texted, you know, her mom, this is where we're going. We're doing this. Everything will be fine. Took her in, you know, did the typical medical stuff, you know, had the evaluation, you know, by psych at that time. And I don't think that first time, maybe, I can't remember if she was admitted that time or not. You know, we waited there, you know, we were seen actually pretty quickly that time, obviously, because it was a medical, you know, emergency. But I think we might have been discharged pretty soon after everything was cleared. But then after that, that's when, you know, then she'd come to me and said, I need to go in. I'm having these thoughts again. I want to die. And if we don't go, you know, I'm going to try it. I'm going to do it again. And again, she'd go to me. And so then instead of going through the emergency department side, we go through the psych side. And if anybody who's been through that, especially, you know, waiting to be evaluated takes a long time.
Yeah.
And I think maybe the second time, because B had an outpatient provider, even though it wasn't really that therapeutic yet, they did another evaluation and, you know, she was discharged back to her outpatient provider.
Again. Okay. And so what was her diagnosis at that time?
You know, at that time it probably was, you know, major, you know, it's hard to say major depressive disorder, you know, with, you know, suicidal ideations. But also if those ideations, you know, are gone or controlled, or you have an outpatient, you know, therapist and you do a safety check, you know, in the home, or you have, you know, well-meaning, you know, parents that can, you know, supervise the patient for the next, you know, 24, 48 hours type of thing, then there's, you know, there's limited resources. So they try and do as much as they can outpatient.
Yeah.
So one of these times, it's hard. They all kind of blur now because this was several years ago. But, you know, she really, I think one of these times should have been admitted. But I remember this time, her mom, I think, like, locked her in her room and actually stayed in her room to watch her. And it wasn't going well, you know, escalated. And it wasn't long again, probably another 48 hours, where we're back in the, you know, psych emergency department. And this time, you know, we needed to admit her for some acute treatment. And that's where the wait comes in. And again, even being a physician, you think that we can work the system. But this was the first, you know, for the next year and a half, you know, I was in that psych, you know, emergency department with her probably 14, 15 times.
Wow.
Four admissions. All of them were admissions. None of them were discharges at that time. Every time now we went in, they were admissions. And I remember sleeping in the, calling, getting my shifts covered, sleeping in the way, you know, and we do here at U of M. So in my, you know, one of my waiting rooms, sleeping in the chair, you know, next to my daughter for a day and a half, sometimes 2 days, waiting for a bed to open up either at U of M or in a, you know, another facility in Michigan.
Wow.
And this happened, we had averaged probably one, sometimes two a month, you know, for the, and we had two more suicide attempts during that time. One of them, I was out of the state in a conference and I got the call. This one was a you know, relatively serious one with cutting. B then, you know, as her mental health really started going downhill, started getting more and more serious, started doing more and more, you know, types of self-harm to try and just feel something. Started medication, did the whole medication dance, trying to find something that worked. And it took even until the last year to find something.
Wow.
This is almost a four-year journey to find a combination of this.
And I'm thinking about all the times that you were taking her to the hospital, having to wait. She gets admitted. What, I mean, how long was she typically inpatient? Was it pretty short, a couple of days or?
No, so they all were at least a week.
Okay.
And then I think there's a time frame on 10 days to 2 weeks to where it crosses that line from a short-term stay to then a residential type or a long term facility type of thing. And a lot of that's based on insurance. And a lot of that is also geared up to what the institution is, you know, resourced for. So there are more, there's not that many, you know, there's only a handful, but there are more short stay units, you know, acute care units in Michigan. Then there are residential facilities, and residential facilities usually take about 3 months. And this is where, you know, they're checked in, you know, they work on a long-term plan after an acute care stay. There really are none in Michigan. You have to go out of state.
Wow.
And so after a few times with Bridget, B's last, one of her attempts, it might have been her last one. That's where we finally, they were over in Grand Rapids at the time, which was about a 3-hour, 4-hour drive from us. And, you know, we had have to go out there alternate times throughout the week to visit her. That was a time where, you know, we looked around and started looking at some residential places. And going into her halfway through her junior year, that's when we put her into one of these in Chicago.
Okay.
And she was, that was the first, you know, the beginning of trying to look at this as a longer term, with all these short-term band-aids. I mean, by this time, this was probably 7 short-stay admissions, you know, 7 or 8, 9 ED psych unit admission, you know, visits over about a 7-month period.
How did you cope with that? I mean, this, I've had several parents on the Just a Mom podcast who have had their child admitted once, twice, maybe 3 times. But goodness, dozens of times, long-term stays. Like, how are you coping with this?
The only way I could do it is, for me to just break it down to literally day by day, minute by minute type of thing. After a while, I felt relieved when B was in as an inpatient, wherever they were, because then I knew they were safe.
Yep.
When they were out, it was just a matter of time. I knew it. I was, on pins and needles, because she'd always come to me when I'm getting that call. And it was always in off hours when we were alone, where she'd feel safe to come to me to take her in. And it would happen all hours of the day or night. It seemed like it was always after a midnight shift.
Yeah.
But I looked at it like, when she's inpatient, I can now rest comfortably and I can sleep. And then I would just look, and I would look at B, and I'd visit her, or we'd talk on the phone when we had chance, and just take solace in the tiny little steps that she'd make. And she still had a lot of satisfaction from her schoolwork. And so she was able to do a lot of schoolwork online. This was before COVID, mm-hmm. and they still had a lot of online classes and Mabel that she could transition. All of her AP classes she had to give up, which was a big, pain for her, because she really enjoyed those. So that kind of hurt. But, at the day, she just wanted, that was a nice distraction, and she just wanted to get through that. And, toward the end, before, then fast forwarding, she had been in these places enough to where she was leading group therapy sessions. And, I think one of the therapists went to her and said, you're to the point now where you just kind of need to choose what kind of life you want. I mean, do you want to just stay around here until you're an adult and then you'll be somebody that goes in and out of adult psych wards, or do you want to kind of move on and take some responsibility yourself rather than just relying on others? And I think that was kind of a wake-up call for her, because it really seemed to – that and some medication, really worked at that time. That came from a therapist that she really trusted.
Sorry, was that one of the long-term stays that she had?
No, she went to Chicago for 6 weeks. And that was a place that we just, I have a couple friends up at, various places in Chicago. And some actually, one's a nurse practitioner in one of the pediatric hospitals up there. And she asked around and had some recommendations, had some friends who'd worked at this long-term facility or this, place that had a good reputation, but, they hadn't worked there in a while, Went up there, and it turns out that it wasn't as therapeutic or as good as a place that, hearing from Bridget, from B about this, that did not, with things that happened there, gave her a lot of, stories about other things that were going on. They put, they wouldn't segregate the type of mental health needs of the kids. And so you'd have eating disorders next to, more depression, and then more with suicide, and then you'd have, some personality disorders and some anger. All the kids were together. And so somebody like B, who was, triggered with loud noises and, outbursts and shouting, that was her trigger from a lot of PTSD that she had, before this. That was the every day that, and so it was really not therapeutic at all. She finally was able to, let us know. And we were able to get her into a wonderful facility in Wisconsin called Rogers. And we just transferred her from Chicago to Rogers and worked on a DBT therapy there. Unfortunately, it really was a 3-month program, and insurance, again, is, it would only pay for another. I was able to argue with them to pay for, I think, 7 or 8 weeks. They're only going to pay for 6. And even though the therapist there were saying that she needed another, 4 or 5 weeks to complete the program, insurance wouldn't. And we even paid an extra, I think, week out of pocket. And then, but you know, it's like $2,000 a day type of thing. Ugh. You know, it just gets, prohibitive. So, but at the time, Bridget had gained a lot of knowledge, a lot of skills with DBT, which really, helped a lot with her, and she could use them. She didn't realize it at the time, but, it really helped her going forward. That didn't mean we were out of the woods yet.
Yeah.
That was in the winter going into the spring.
Okay. Junior year.
Yeah. In the spring of her junior year. And then, came back out, played lacrosse for a little bit. But then the kids, as kids can be mean, word had got out somewhere. And they started looking at her like, she's just got out of an insane asylum, and, started making a lot of the talk behind her back. And the friend group that she was in before now all of a sudden isolated her, and she'd been gone for a while,
This is the first of a two-part series with Kyle. My conversation with Kyle will continue on episode 13, which will be available Tuesday, April 16th. Please make sure to subscribe, rate, and share these episodes. And thanks again for listening to the Just a Mom podcast.